Appeals, we only have one case on the docket for oral argument this afternoon, so I'm going to do things a little bit out of order, but not too much. I see that the parties are already seated at the table, so I'm going to go ahead and do some instructions there. As you each know, you each get 20 minutes to argue. I'm assuming that the appellants have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. If not, you know, they're the people to talk to, not to me. Our lighting system, though, when the yellow light goes on, that means that you have 2 minutes left in whatever portion of the argument that you're making. When you see the yellow light kind of start to wrap things up, when you see red come on, certainly wrap things up. Go ahead and feel free to conclude the answer to the question that's been posed. And if you seek more time, go ahead and ask for leave of court. Don't just do that on your own. Today's proceedings are being audio recorded. The recordings will be available on the court's website within the next day or two. Housekeeping, if anyone has a cell phone or other device that's that would make any noise, please silence it, turn it off. We don't want that to detract from the arguments being made by the attorneys. And I think then with that, we're going to go ahead and get started. I'll ask for announcements, and then I'll let y'all proceed immediately into argument. Cause number 03191185CV, the Texas Department of Insurance versus the Texas Association of Health Plans. And for the appellant? Okay, and then for the appellee?
Matthew Baumgartner for appellee.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And whenever you're ready, sir.
May it please the court. The Texas Association of Health Plans, or TAP, has not asserted any injury to itself in this lawsuit. Accordingly, TAP cannot maintain its rule challenge claims under the plain language of Section 2001-038 of the APA, which requires an injury to the plaintiff. Now, TAP also cannot maintain its statutory validity claims because its single paragraph conclusory assertion that four separate insurance code provisions are unconstitutional is in itself insufficient to establish jurisdiction under the UDJA. Now again, we're before this court on just two limited jurisdictional issues. First, Section 2001-038 of the APA explicitly limits who may maintain a rule challenge claim against a state agency. The statute establishes an action for declaratory relief if it is alleged that the rule interferes with or impairs a legal right or privilege of the plaintiff. Now, the statute does not simply say that the validity of a rule may be challenged in an action for a declaratory judgment, as the legislature could have said. Instead, those additional words "of the plaintiff" must mean something. And under the plain text, what it means is that only a person who is injured by a rule may bring a lawsuit to challenge it, or conversely, the statute does not permit a third party to vindicate the rights of another injured person. Now, if there was any doubt about the plain text, because that statute, Section 2001-038, is a waiver of sovereign immunity, it must be construed narrowly against exercising jurisdiction over any state defendant, as we have here. And because TAP has not alleged any impairment to its own legal rights or privileges in this lawsuit, it cannot maintain its rule challenge claims under Section 2001-038.
So, Mr. Green, there's a supplement that, or an OA exhibit that was given to us that outlines the eight cases primarily relied upon by the association to say, hey, look, court, you've done this, you know, a number of times. Why isn't this line of cases, why aren't these enough to show you know, the very question that you're asking this court to revisit, or it feels like you're asking this court to revisit?
We're not. I mean, none of those cases have explicitly construed the language in this statute. They may have found that an association had associational standing, but we're not making a constitutional argument.
Well, and in any of these cases, was that issue ever specifically joined?
No, I do not believe, and I think plaintiff concedes that it has not been joined, that no court has construed the "of the plaintiff" language that's at issue here. And now TAP is wrong.
Well, now, how easy would it be, though, for them to just, you know, bring in a member and, you know, include them? And would that be enough then? Would they then be able to proceed along with their member?
The member would, and I suppose that they might be able to join because someone would have an injury. But again, that member would need to join and assert its own injury, you know, that's arising out of
can
this challenge.
Can they replead,
rule.
Or can they start the
I don't know that they could replead. I mean,
because it's a new
a
party.
Member could bring a new lawsuit, though, theoretically,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And again, TAP is wrong in arguing that it can maintain this rule challenge claim just under the doctrine of associational standing alone.
Have they met associational standing here?
I don't think we're contesting that they have, no.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct, so they have. But again, standing just sets the bare constitutional minimum for proceeding in court. But establishing standing or associational standing is not a substitute for satisfying a distinct statutory condition on maintaining a lawsuit like the who may sue condition that's set forth in section 2001-038. And now at TAP, they principally rely upon Norwood out of the Texas Supreme Court and then this court's decision in Valquinta, but neither case held that a third party or an association could maintain a section 038 claim to vindicate the rights of a member or some other injured person. Now, in a footnote in Norwood, the court did observe that the type of injury that would ordinarily be sufficient to satisfy the injury requirement in standing would also satisfy section 038's impairment requirement. And then that was repeated again in this court's decision in Valquinta. But again, neither court was construing the of the plaintiff language, and neither case held that a membership organization or any other third party could maintain an 038 claim on behalf of another injured person, such as a member. And neither case could have reached that holding because the plaintiffs in both cases were asserting injuries to their own interests. And again, in short, neither case addressed the of the plaintiff language, and no case has that we're aware of, and passed on the precise issue that's in front of this court.
So, Mr. Green, then Justice Pemberton's comment in Valquinta, I believe it's on 744, the analytical linchpin of the appellant's argument, the notion that the interference with or impairment of legal right or privilege contemplated by APA 2001-038 is narrower than constitutional standing requirements has recently been rejected by the Supreme Court, and, you know, going on and on. That's to you
a separate issue. It's where the type of injury, that's what that speaks to, that satisfies the Constitution would satisfy 038. It would be an impairment to a legal right if you met the injury requirement for standing for the constitutional purposes. But it did not pass on whether or who is allowed to bring that claim against a rule. That was just not an issue in either case. Now, turning to TAP's UDJA claims, the statutory validity challenge, TAP's petition makes clear that a court can reach those claims only if the court first rejects the rule challenge APA claims on the merits. They've pled this claim as an alternative claim. So in other words, a court can only assess the constitutionality of those statutes after concluding that the challenged rules are valid under those statutes. So therefore, if the court concludes that it lacks jurisdiction to consider the APA rule challenge claims, it would also lack jurisdiction to consider the UDJA claims. But even if the court did have jurisdiction over the rule challenge claims, TAP's single paragraph conclusory assertion that four separate statutes in the insurance code are all unconstitutional private delegations in itself is insufficient to maintain jurisdiction under the UDJA, because not all private delegations of governmental authority are unconstitutional per se. There's a test. There's the Texas Bollweevil test that sets forth eight separate factors to consider to determine whether a private delegation is unconstitutional. And to maintain a statutory validity challenge in this court and in Texas, you have to assert a viable constitutional claim, meaning at least on the face of the claim, it must state a claim that would entitle you to relief under the Constitution. And that means addressing the factors that make the private delegation unconstitutional. And TAP's pleading did not do so. It simply stated that they are unconstitutional without assessing why under any of those factors. And because it failed to address those factors, it cannot maintain that claim on the bare assertion that they're simply unconstitutional. If there's nothing further, I can reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Well, I wanted to make sure Are you familiar with the City of Houston and propane gas decision issued by this court recently? Justice Kelly wrote that.
I'm not familiar with it.
Okay.
But I'll be happy to address it if it's real.
That's all right. Thank you.
May it please the court. I will start by responding to TDI's argument that this statute imposes a narrow requirement on who can sue than any plaintiff who could establish statutory standing, and submit to the court that a plain text reading of the statute does not support TDI's argument and in fact supports the argument that an association who can meet the associational standing test, which the association has done here, can sue under this statute.
Can I get out of the way? Just, you know, why not just have a member?
It's a fair strategic question, Your Honor.
It seems pretty easy, too.
I think, in all bluntness, it is easy, but there are many strategic reasons why associations bring suits that get into privilege and legal strategy and things of that nature. But I would say, because it is a very practical, common sense question that the mm-hmm. court asks, that the associational standing test makes a lot of sense in many cases, and we've handed up oral argument exhibits that. Guide the court through some of these issues. And in Exhibit 1, if you look at the bottom left-hand corner, we cite a case from a 1996 case from the United States Supreme Court that explains the concept of associational standing and why it's a good jurisprudential doctrine. And there, as the court makes clear, associations can meet constitutional standing, bring lawsuits on behalf of their members to seek redress for injuries that their members suffer directly when they can meet the Hunt test, which includes proof of direct injury to the members' interests in a way that is germane to the organization's purpose. And when that test is met, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, the association and its members are in every practical sense identical. And that's just true as a matter of law in federal court and in Texas court, and has been so for a long, long time. So, why does that matter here under this statute? Because what the statute says, we know for certain what part of the statutory language that TDI keys its argument on means. Norwood told us, and this court in Valquinta told us, for certain what that phrase, a legal right or privilege, means. It means constitutional standing. That's a settled issue. TDI is not contesting that. So the only other words in the statute that are at issue are of the plaintiff. So let's do a plain text analysis of the whole phrase, a legal right or injury of the plaintiff. A plaintiff who can establish constitutional standing. That's what the statute means under its plain text. And we have that here.
What about the thought that just because, like, the eight cases that you put in your attachment, just because they allowed the associational standing does not necessarily mean that they answered the question of whether or not sovereign immunity still barred because the issue wasn't joined.
Yes, Your Honor. So we concede that in those eight cases, the state did not argue in any of them that of the plaintiff excludes associations. This is a novel argument that would very much upset the apple cart. Mm-hmm. I mean, associations from...
Keep going.
Yes.
I got a follow-up to that. Keep your thought going.
Of course. But what I would add to the upsetting of the apple cart and really cast doubt on a well-settled, the court's well-settled understanding that associations can sue under this statute and invoke the waiver of sovereign immunity, is this court's discussion in Valquinta, where it addressed, where Justice Pemberton's opinion addressed the conceptual differences between sovereign immunity and standing as applied to this statute. And that's on pages 744 to 745. The discussion begins with the quote that Justice Kelly just mentioned a moment ago. And I think a fair reading of that analysis shows that it doesn't really matter which doctrine is invoked here. What Norwood held, and what this court is therefore bound by, is that the expression in the statute, a legal right or injury of a plaintiff, means one thing, a plaintiff who can establish constitutional standing. That plaintiff, and we have one here, it's undisputed, as counsel just admitted. Once you have such a plaintiff who can establish constitutional standing, and we do that here through associational standing, once you have that, you can invoke the waiver of sovereign immunity for the type of lawsuit being asserted, which is a challenge to an agency, to the validity of an agency rule. That should be the complete analysis. And the court's discussion in Balquinta about the differences between sovereign immunity and standing, and tying that back to what Norwood said about this statute, I think is dispositive.
And so then that was the next thought I wanted to go to. Are you familiar with the Engelman Irrigation District versus Shields case?
Not off the top of my head.
I can give you a cite for it because you may, well, so the site is 514 Southwest 3rd, 746. It's an opinion written by Justice Willett. Says in there, it's true we've stated that sovereign immunity is a jurisdictional bar, talking about Miranda, and that in Miranda, we, and he quotes, said, in Texas, sovereign immunity deprives a court of subject matter jurisdiction for lawsuits in which a state or governmental units have been sued or unless the state consents to suit. But more recently, we've been more guarded in our description of the interplay of jurisdiction and sovereign immunity in three decisions, then going to Bell, Houston Bell, Manbeck, and Rusk State Hospital. Then he puts great emphasis on, we stated in those cases quite deliberately that sovereign immunity implicates a trial court's jurisdiction. We did not hold that sovereign immunity equates to a lack of subject matter jurisdiction for all purposes, or that sovereign immunity so implicates subject matter jurisdiction that it allows a collateral attack on a final judgment, which was the question in this case. These cases, I mean, we've assumed a lot in issuing these opinions. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the Engelman decision, and since you're not, you know, you're not familiar with it off the top of your head, I'm going to invite, if you'd like an opportunity, to let me know your thoughts on how that would implicate this case. I'd be most interested, because there's some language in here that's really, it kind of, it moved how I think about things like standing and sovereign immunity and those kinds of issues.
Of course. I certainly agree with Justice Willett's general principles there. I think that's very well stated, in fact. Here, though, focusing the principles of standing and sovereign immunity on this particular statute, what we have are really two concepts built into the same statute. We have a waiver of sovereign immunity for a particular kind of lawsuit, and then we have a description of who can invoke that waiver of sovereign immunity, what plaintiff. And we have a term, a plaintiff who can establish an injury or a threatened injury to a legal right or privilege. That's what the statute said. Now, that last language, that last part of it, is all about, as constitutional standing or statutory standing always is, who can sue. You need a plaintiff who can establish an injury that's redressable by the claims before the court. That's always true in every case. That's true because of separation of powers. Sovereign immunity is a different concept. And here, for all of the statute's requirements to be met, for there to be a waiver of sovereign immunity, there has to be an appropriate type of claim. It can only be a challenge to an agency rule. And it can only be brought by a plaintiff who can establish an injury to a legal right or privilege. That second part of it is the only thing that's at issue here, and we know what it means, because Norwood said, we treat the acts requirement as but another expression of the general doctrine of standing, and we think it's frankly slicing the salami a bit too thin to say of the plaintiff means certain kinds of plaintiffs but excludes other kinds of plaintiffs. Plaintiff is a broad term. The legislature knows, as this court knows when it issued all of these eight decisions, that plaintiffs can be associations, because it's been so well established in the law for so long that associations, where they meet the Hunt test and where they appropriately step in the shoes of their members, there's no practical difference. So as a matter of law, those plaintiffs are one and the same with their members. That's what the statute requires. And Bell Quinta didn't slice it that thin either. Bell Quinta, at least twice, talked about this phrase as a whole, a legal right or privilege of the plaintiff. There always has to be a plaintiff. And there's no magical meaning to of the plaintiff in this statute that doesn't exist in the general doctrine of constitutional standing or in other statutes. And so, and if you take a look at the flow chart on Exhibit 1, the constitutional standing box, the requirement of a personal injury is nothing new and nothing particular to this statute. That also exists within the doctrine of constitutional standing. In other words, for any plaintiff, an association or an individual, to meet constitutional standing, the plaintiff must, and I quote from the Heckman decision, Texas Supreme Court 2012, the plaintiff must be personally injured. He must plead facts demonstrating that he, rather than a third party or the public at large, suffered the injury. That's very similar language to what Section 2001.038 requires a plaintiff to show an injury to a legal right or a privilege. So constitutional standing and Section 2001.038 have basically the same requirement, that you have a plaintiff establishing personal injury. Now, that has legal meaning. A plaintiff who can establish a personal injury has legal meaning. And what the courts have said is associations, even though they cannot show injury to the association itself, and the Supreme Court has expressly addressed this, even though there's no injury to the association itself, they can meet the standing requirement and meet the personal injury requirement of constitutional standing because they stand in the members' shoes.
Could you repeat that if you can?
Yes, and I think it's an important sort of syllogism here, because I think the rub of the state's argument, just to take a step back, because I think this is an important concept. The rub of the state's argument is the statute does something different than constitutional standing. It's narrower, it imposes a higher standard, it narrows the class of people who can bring suit from those who could merely establish constitutional standing.
But the legislature's free to do that, particularly when it comes to waiving the state's sovereign immunity. I mean, that's exactly where they do it.
The legislature has expressly waived sovereign immunity in this case for any plaintiff who can establish that an agency rule has impaired a legal right or privilege. And so the question then is, as a matter of plain text, common sense, established doctrine, rulings, what does that mean? Who is a plaintiff that can establish a legal right or injury? And associations clearly meet that test, whether you're talking about statutory standing or constitutional standing, because what Norwood said is it's one and the same. This is an expression of the constitutional standing requirement. So the Supreme Court of Texas has already said what the legislature intended to do here. The legislature used the broad term, the generic term, plaintiff. It did not use the term individualized or personally aggrieved plaintiffs only. And in fact, if this court were to agree with TDI's argument, we think that would be tantamount to reading words into the statute that the legislature itself did not put there. And I would also note that there's a case from Houston, the eighth case on our list in Exhibit 2. I believe that case was transferred to a Houston Court of Appeals on a docket equalization transfer. And that court, as courts must do, examined its jurisdiction sua sponte. And it did so particularly on this issue of associational standing and said the association there established jurisdiction for this claim through the doctrine of associational standing and therefore met Section 2001.038's requirement. So that's a very clear statement by the Houston court that associational standing can be invoked here to waive sovereign immunity for the right type of claim. And that's how the two concepts work together. And I will be happy to, and thank you for the court's invitation to do so, in a post-hearing letter brief. Engelman versus Shields is the opinion, 514.
Shields Brothers, yep.
Okay.
514 Southwest 3rd, 746.
And if there are no further questions.
And there's also some interesting language in there about how sovereign immunity kind of, it's not necessarily subject matter jurisdiction, but it's kind of akin to that, and it's also kind of akin to personal jurisdiction, the concepts. And so, you know, if it's personal, then it certainly can be waived. The question of sovereign immunity.
Yes, I agree with all those principles in Justice Willett's description that you read. And would thank you for the court's invitation to brief the application of those principles here. If the court has no further questions on the first issue, I'll pivot now to the second issue that TDI has raised. And this one is an interesting one. Initially, TDI pleaded that the association, or TDI, excuse me, argued in its opening brief that the association had not pleaded a viable UDJA claim challenging the validity of the statutory provisions. And I think TDI has conceded in its reply brief at page 4 that the association did in fact do that. And it's important to understand the nature of this claim. This is a claim strictly in the alternative. So there is, TDI says, this amounts to a redundant claim that merely seeks an interpretation for which the UDJA does not waive sovereign immunity. So two arguments, redundancy and no waiver of sovereign immunity. But that's incorrect because both are based on a incorrect characterization of what the claim is. And what the claim is an alternative one brought only to the statute's validity, and it's only reached if and only if the interpretation given to those statutes in the first claim is one that supports what we say as a unconstitutional private delegation. So here's the way it works: is in the agency, in the challenge to the agency's rules, which is for which sovereign immunity is waived under Section 2001.038, the APA DEC action section, the court is going to have to interpret the statutes. The court is going to have to say yay or nay to whether the statutes support the rules. We think that the court will say nay. We think that the statutes do not support the agency's rules. They do not support rules mandating that health plans pay whatever amounts medical providers put on their unregulated, privately determined, and in most cases astronomically high and increasing it by the day, bill charges that this court and the Texas Supreme Court have recognized are untethered to any economic reality or regulation. We think the court is going to say, no, the statutes don't support these rules. But, and here's why it's an alternative claim, if they do, if the statutes do support or mandate those rules, which place solely in the hands of the medical providers themselves, these private entities, the ability to dictate how much health plans pay simply by invoking these statutes and rules, that is an unconstitutional delegation to unregulated private entities without any adequate state review, without any input by an interested party into the process, and without any standards in setting those charges. We've pleaded all of that. Of course we have. We've all not only pleaded it, but we've briefed it. We briefed it in response to a summary judgment motion and a plea to the jurisdiction, and we have 4 separate affidavits explaining exactly those facts. And that's important to understand because TDI has pivoted in response to its acknowledgement that, yes, this is an alternative claim for not just a statutory construction, but a statutory validity. They acknowledge that on page 4 of their reply, and they pivoted to this argument that we haven't laid out enough facts. So two things. This is a facial challenge to the statutes. And we have pleaded facts about what they mean on their face that are relevant to the boll weevil test. Now, we did not create a bullet point list of the boll weevil factors in our briefing. We think that not all the Bolt-Weevil factors apply to every case. Clearly not all of them apply in civil cases. One of them is specific to criminal penalties. We pleaded the facts that are relevant here, and there are three, the most important of which is laid out by the Texas Supreme Court in the FM Properties case, and that is whether the private delegate's actions is subject to any meaningful state review, and here it is not. Now, finally, an important point that I just don't want to get lost, and I see that I'm running out of time, but may I briefly? The remedy for this, if the court were to indulge what we think is really a merits-based argument that, you know, not enough facts have been pleaded here, the remedy for that is leave to replead the right facts, and if that's what the court thinks needs to be done. Frankly, I think the district court should pass on that question first, because it's an argument raised first on appeal. But the district court, if the district court thinks that's necessary, we'd be happy to replead sort of in bullet point fashion the Bolt-Weevil factors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Just a few points. I just want to be clear that an association that alleged an injury to itself would be able to proceed under Section 038 in under the plain language of the APA. So I think counsel sort of suggested that we're against all associations ever going forward. That's not the case. Any association that alleges its own injury has an avenue for relief here. Secondly, the Constitution and the statutory bars that are at issue here are not the same, and they can't be conflated. As this court has said in the Stop the Ordinances case, which we cite, that the Constitution, it sets the bare minimum, the absolute floor for getting into court. That's what, and a statute that's at issue here that waives sovereign immunity does just the opposite. It must be read narrowly to preserve the state's ability, its immunity, and therefore the lack of jurisdiction over the claim against the state. And not only that, the statute also serves to ensure that there's the most direct controversy between the parties, the actual plaintiff who is injured itself against the state. It also conserves judicial resources. There are reasons to read the statute narrowly and differently from the constitutional standing requirement, which again is the bare floor for what someone needs to do to get into court. And again, the Norwood case just did not address these issues. It did not and could not have assessed the of the plaintiff language because the associations, well, there was no association in Norwood at all. It was just individual plaintiffs that were challenging home equity loan rules that injured themselves. And then in Valquinta, there was an association, but it asserted its own injury. It was not bringing an associational standing claim. So the 038 language that's at issue here just was not passed on by those courts.
Same question that I asked. Are you familiar with the Engelman irrigation case?
No, but I would welcome the opportunity to,
yes,
to read it and address it as well. Sure.
Please. It's got some really interesting language in there. So, and it's not on all fours, but it certainly is got some interesting language. Yeah.
I will be happy to address it.
Thank you.
And I believe in final and closing, it's actually TAP that is seeking to read out language that's in this statute. Those words of the plaintiff have to mean something. They mean the specific party that's before the court has to have its own injury. It can't possibly mean somebody else. And so we're just asking the court to follow that plain language, and the language that has not been construed by Norwood or any other court. So in conclusion, in sum, that the court should render judgment dismissing TAP's petition.
Before you conclude, did you look at the Texas BLC on the associational standing question, and what would you say about its impact in this case?
I mean, meeting associational standing is never going to satisfy 038. I mean, that's the short answer of it. It's just a different issue. If you're only relying on associational standing, that
but then
means
what do we do with all of those cases that have allowed associational standing to that have assumed associational standing? Let's go there.
I mean,
that have assumed it, and then the legislature hasn't touched it since. I mean,
well,
they've been like, yeah, okay.
You can't pass quietly over a jurisdictional question and assume that it means anything. That this court should make clear that when someone is before this court trying to bring a rule challenge, that person, be it an association or an individual, has his own injury or its own injury. That's the only way that you can challenge a rule under the statute. So, in sum, the court should render judgment dismissing TAP's petition in its entirety. Thank you.
Any other questions?
you have any questions?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. And with that, the case will be submitted. This court stands in recess, and if you'll give us just a minute.
All please rise.